What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Right now in Fast, Nike shares heading sharply lower after its latest earnings report. The stock is now down 3%. We're dialed into the call. We'll bring you all the details and the trade. Plus, a Micron meltdown just 24 hours ago. Investors were cheering a more than 5% post-earnings pop, but the stock gave up those gains and then some during today's session. What the reversal says about the state of this stock. And later, Fidelity jumps on the Bitcoin bandwagon. Disney tries to find some magic, and Apple closes in on $3 trillion. I'm Melissa Lee. This is Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site. On the desk tonight, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, Guy Adami, and Tim Seymour. We're going to get to Nike in just a moment, but first, on a day where the Dow outperformed big tech and rates hit levels not seen since the SVB collapse, we thought we'd ask our traders one simple question. What chart tells the true tale of what is going on in the markets? Dan, which chart did you choose?
All right, so I have a friend, Liz Young. You know, she's on the Halftime Report. Well, she's actually our friend. Collectively.
Yeah. Network. Yeah.
Brilliant strategist over there at the SoFi. And she tweeted this out. I'm not on Twitter anymore. Someone actually had forwarded it over email, but she tweeted out a chart the other day of the S&P 500, okay, versus where real rates are. So that would be the, you know, interest rates relative to inflation. And I thought this was really interesting because you see that divergence, right? And Guy Adami has been talking about this a lot. He's seen a lot of the performance in the S&P 500 this year is really multiple expansion, right? And so we've often quoted where the S&P 500 is trading at about 19 times on a forward basis, which I think per fact set is above the 5 and 10 year averages, is down there near 18. So something's got to give between where the Fed is bringing interest rates, right, and relative to inflation expectations, and where valuations of the S&P 500 are trading. So I think this is a really interesting chart, and I think it could actually be the key to how stocks perform in the second half of the year when we have better clarity on inflation, better clarity on where interest rates are going to go or stay, and really something's got to give with the stock market.
Yeah. Something's got to give, meaning stocks have to come down.
Or you just see, like, yes, I mean, like, I think that's probably has to happen.
Yeah. Tim, do you think that's how something gives in this scenario?
I do. And I would point to a chart that's all about rates as well. And I agree that real rates are way too low. S&P should not be trading at a forward multiple above where it was trading pre-COVID. So Dan's chart, Liz Young's chart, all great stuff. I would show that the two-year chart is one that we're within 15 bips of the high for this period, but we're within essentially 15 bips of a 16-year high in two-year rates, another 25 bips or so on that, and you're back to 2006 or 2007. So you're at an extraordinary place here for the consumer. And we saw jobless claims this morning. We saw GDP upward revisions this morning that were probably consumer-based. In other words, they were better than people had expected in terms of consumption level. But I'm looking at disposable income as a percentage, debt levels as a percentage of disposable income, almost 10%. I'm looking at debt coverage ratios at 17-year highs. I'm looking at consumer credit that's up 12.5% over the last 12 months to $1.23 trillion or so. It's just, you know, at some point, this is the problem, that rates haven't been this high and they're going up off of zero. So equity valuations are reflected from the long end, which is what I think Dan and Liz are talking about. And I would just put the pressure on the consumer here. I think the consumer is under a lot of pressure. And I think it means, and we'll talk about retail later in the show with Jerry Storch, but this has a lot of implications for retail stocks and even hard lines, soft lines, and other places that have been defensive.
I feel like it's sort of a companion chart because Guy has the 10-year.
It's interesting that Tim and I would be companions. We went to school together. And remember the other night when Tim couldn't hear Tim? Remember how nice I was to him? Remember?
He said he had good hair. He had steely eyes.
Great singer.
We could have gone all the whole direction.
All the real deal.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Your chart?
Oh, I thought I didn't realize you were going to come to me.
Yeah,
my chart is, again, it is a companion to Tim's, and it's choose tens, which is now either side of a 1% inversion. And I think six of the last, well, basically since Fed tightening cycles have occurred, It's predicted six basically recessions out of seven. A magnitude that we're seeing now, 100% inversion since the 1950s, has led to a recession, I think, 80-something percent of the time. And with the steepness of it now, we haven't seen that in the last, I don't know, 40-something years. And typically, the range is 15 months from when it started. And we're right there. I think August, September, October puts you right in the window. So, again, I'm not an economist, but I think people are sort of not looking at this closely enough to indicate what it's going to mean in the months to come, Melms.
There's no shot in your head that the markets see or are pricing in a recession at this point?
If the market is pricing in a recession at the multiple
that
we're trading at.
Or that we had priced in a recession?
Yeah. Listen, is there going to be a soft landing? Have they been able to navigate this? Does this inversion mean nothing? The fact that we've been inverted for about 13, 14 mm-hmm. months, 100 basis points, probably headed at this point to 125. Could that be an anomaly? Absolutely. The market says that right now. I just don't believe that's going to be the case.
Karen, what's your chart?
Yeah, so I had sort of a different take on the question, and my chart is just a very long look back at the S&P, and to me, that, you know, what does that tell you? That you want to be in the S&P over time. And when you step back, I mean, sure, there's dips in it. There's the SNL crisis. There's the bubble of the first dot-com bubble. There's the great financial crisis. There's the pandemic. And I am long into every single crisis. Always long. And I just think you can see from this chart just the power of compounding. It just, you want to be in the market. So to me, that's sort of the, I don't know the squigglies, how they're going to work. Mm-hmm. I just want to stay long. So that's the chart that is sort of.
I think what you're saying is the most important thing about anybody who wants to invest a dollar in the market. I heard you say it on her podcast, actually, the other day. And honestly, it was great.
I know we talked.
You guys did talk about this. And I actually think it's really important. OK, so the show's called Fast Money here. And a lot of us grew up as traders. Some people grew up as investors. But your point is an amazing one. Let's just look at the last 3 years. Right. The S&P topped out in February of 2020 at 3600. It went down 35% in a black swan event to 2200 or whatever the heck it is. And here we are now at 4400. We were 4800. If you just invested the same dollar amount every month, every quarter, this, that, you'd be doing fantastic. And that's the squiggly that you're talking about. But the fast money component of this is like, if you're tuning into this, you like the day to day, you like the action, you like the different stories in this. And sometimes, so we get in the weeds a little bit about that. And I always say to people that if you are invested in the long term, you take advantage of that compounding nature. But sometimes if like a portion of your investable assets is you like the action, right? You like the stories like that. The trading part about it is like that's where you're YOLOing stuff, whether it's crypto, whether it's this or whatever. And so I agree with you. I think that is the most important takeaway, though, of your chart, too, is like you always have to be in the market.
Yes, you always. Right. I can't figure out when to sell and then when to get back in mm-hmm. and have it wake up for taxes. I mean, there's no shot of my getting that right both ways.
But in terms of your take on what the squiggly does next, it is what?
I don't know. and I don't think it's a monolith.
But you don't care,
right?
You know, if the consumer, like as Tim had outlined, if the consumer is weak, right, that impacts a lot of your trades in terms of the retail component of your trades, like a Lowe's, for instance, or, I mean, TJ Maxx, you know, all of these.
Right. Also, though, the market is a forward-looking mechanism, mm-hmm. right? And so it shouldn't be shocked every time that sometimes you get in these markets where the same news makes it go down again and again and again. And sometimes the market looks through. And I think generally the market kind of looks through.
May I ask you a question? It's your show. You typically ask the questions. Will you give me this one?
Yes.
Maybe I missed, you know, I wasn't here yesterday. So maybe you discussed it yesterday. I'm not quite sure. But is squiggly something? Is that in some new financial term that I'm not aware of? You've used it a few times now.
I wasn't the first to bring up the squiggly.
The squigglies.
The squiggly,
you know,
like is
the
like the, you know,
the, like the,
no,
little,
the squiggly. The
longer term trajectory of the market is higher.
Uh-huh. So it's squiggly.
But sometimes there are little squigglies, meaning sometimes
but
you go up.
But there's a really important point,
gyrations.
Though. But Mel, this is one thing that's really important, is that like a lot of investors make a lot of decisions, like bad decisions at highs and at lows.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we try to figure out where the next squiggly is going to be, because you don't want to be buying.
You did call the squiggly of the end of 21.
Right, but you don't want to be. But you don't want to be buying into a mania right before you know that that thing might kind of deflate a little bit, despite the fact that the long term is bottom left, upper right for the whole thing, right? And that's why we talk about a lot of these rotations and everything. And when you use that expression, I love to get Tim's kind of take on this really quickly too. Is like when you think about all of the charts that we started with, okay, if we know over history, like the 15 months from the time that the 210 inverts that we're likely to have, you know, like, a recession or this, and whatever, well, we're kind of there for all that sort of stuff. So sometimes you throw out the forward-looking sort of thing. I don't know, because I know that he agreed with me. That's why I wanted to get Tim's taken away. Like, I think that but if you think that the October lows discounted the recession that hasn't happened yet, well, then that's you're doing that wrong a little bit, too, in my opinion.
Well, our next guest has his own tale of what is happening in the markets today and how to play it going into the second half of the year. Tony Dwyer is the chief market strategist at Canaccord Genuity. Tony, always good to see you.
I'm squiggly today.
What's the next squiggly, Tony? That's the question.
So I love the conversation. First, you know, I was looking before I came on at what is getting priced into as a recession. So 54% of the S&P 500 is trading more than 20% below its 52-week high. So there's still been a lot of weakness in the market despite the 14% move in the S&P 500. And just to, Mel, speaking to the panel's discussion about earnings yield or two-year yield versus the earnings yield, think about this. When you look at the $220 earnings estimate for 2023 operating earnings, that's a consensus estimate. I'm at 210. At that $220 number, your earnings yield, which for the viewers is the inverse of the PE, so that way you can compare it directly to interest rates, riskless rate of return, the six-month T-bill has given you a 542. You're getting a 5% using the 220 number on an earnings yield, again, E versus P. And on my number of 210, which may prove a little bit optimistic because I'm still in the recession camp, that'd give you a 475. So you have a riskless rate of return that's at least 42 basis points above a consensus number that's higher than my number, and my number is probably a little bit too high. So we're in this squiggly environment where a lot of stocks have already come down quite a bit from their peak, and they're sitting there. The average stock is only up, or not average stock, the median stock in the S&P, in the NYSE this year so far is up 3%. So it's frustrating a lot of fund managers I talked to, myself included.
Hey, Tony, it's Tim. So let me try to synthesize the previous conversation and what you just said, because I think what you're saying is that actually an equal weighted S&P is not up that much. And maybe that's interesting. And the last conversation was really about how can you be a long-term investor, which we all recognize you want to be in terms of empirical results over time at a market top, at a time when Apple, the biggest stock in the world in the market, is up 51% since January 4th. So how do you bring those two concepts together?
And it's the bigger than the entire market cap of the Russell 2000. So tying that in, it doesn't take a lot of selling or a lot of profit taking in those mega cap stocks to give a bid to the broad market. The broad market is nowhere near where that S&P 500 is, where you've got the 19 multiple. I'd call it a 20 multiple on my number. And still, I know it's not real popular. So here's an interesting thing, guys. We keep hearing that we've been talking about a recession for the last X number of months. It's actually been about a year. The median duration between the initial inversion of the six-month to 10-year Treasury curve and the onset of a recession is 11 months. So if this is the most talked about recession of all time, how about the 21-month lead time going into the great financial crisis? I think one of the issues that we're seeing here is everybody's waiting for this kind of SVB moment, this catastrophe or this Lehman moment. How about we just get an old school money contraction? Like, there's three ways you can get money for the next leg of growth. You can earn it. We're already past peak earnings. That's the whole story of why the Fed is going to be able to cut rates down the road, less labor inflation. You can get it from a bank, and we know they're not lending. After the SVB and the regulatory fear, lending standards are pretty, pretty tight. Or you can get it from your investments. And even on the gain of the S&P 500, you're still pretty well below where you were from an all-time high. So again, you know, I don't have a problem with, you don't have to bet against it. The question is, do you want to bet with it, when I can't find the money that's going to fund the next level of growth, and I got a riskless rate of return that's at least 42 basis points above the earnings yield on the S&P.
Tony, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Mel. Good to see everybody. Have a happy fourth.
You too. Tony Dwyer, Canaccord Genuity. I mean, it's a good point on the 6 month riskless 5.5% guy.
Tony always makes good points, number one. And I think what he's saying is don't get fooled. The fact that nothing's happened yet, don't be fooled by it, because back in the day, it took 21 months to get to a level that we all remember. And I don't think he's suggesting we're going back there, but it's something to take into consideration. I'm guilty of this all this time. I think things should happen a lot faster than they have. But the fact that it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that it won't. And again, in my opinion, it's almost a foregone conclusion that the market, the stock market's starting to take in consideration 500 basis points of hikes and a yield curve where we're currently trading at.
So just in terms of soft landing, hard landing, I know you're going to hate this, but the landing, I think, Guy, is a Carrie Strug landing.
Oh, where she fakes the injury and
I don't think she faked it. I think it's a hard landing, but she stuck it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we can agree to disagree.
You know,
she's a fan of the show, by the way. Carrie Strug. Sorry, Carrie.
Is she?
Yeah. Huge. Not anymore.
She had some sort of knee injury or something.
Ankle
injury, and then still, you know, compete. Yes. She got a perfect 10, right?
No, stop
I don't know.
It.
She got good enough.
She's good enough.
That was her. What,
Tim?
Here,
Tim's
going to
chime in.
No,
because now Tim's trying to curry favor with all the gymnasts out there.
I think we're about to go to July 4th weekend and celebrate our country's birthday and feel, you know, a lot of pride about all our achievements, and we're going after one of the most decorated Olympic athletes of our time.
Cereal box. Come on, you can't go after. But in terms of what Karen is saying about sticking the landing, that implies that Jerome Powell, he deserves a gold medal.
Yes. Yeah, I well done there, tying all the metaphors together. And I think the presumption here is that the Fed has done just enough to get us back, to be tight enough on policy to get us back to 2% without causing a recession. There's no way that's happened. It's never happened. And the Fed, who admittedly is waiting for data and is always behind the curve, they won't say that, but everybody else will. So, no, you can't have it both ways here. We either have more to go and there's pain still to be had. But to say that we've done just enough to execute the perfect landing without limping off the mat, I don't think so.
All right. Let's take a check on shares of Nike. Volatile after hours. The athletic wear company reporting a beat on the top line but missing earnings. The stock is up 3.25%. The company's conference call is underway. CNBC's Mike Santoli is following all the action there. Mike, what's the latest?
Yeah, Melissa, first earnings beat, earnings miss for Nike in 3 years or so. By a penny, 66 cents versus 67. Worth noting, the estimate for this quarter that was just reported was 81 cents as of the end of February. So it's two quarters in a row where they've had a really downscale expectation. Still, the stock taking it a little bit tough. Now, below the surface, there's progress on some of the problem areas investors have been worried about. That would be China and inventories. Big comeback in Chinese revenue growth, 16% year over year in the quarter. That was better than anticipated. You also did see inventories flat on a one-year basis, down sequentially, down in terms of volumes. Basically, Nike on the call, John Donahue, the CEO, saying we're back to health when it comes to where we are in inventories. Also highlighting things that they always do, like digital and direct sales. Very fast growth there. Digital up 26%. It's also 23% of the overall revenue base. Probably still some squeezing of the wholesale channel going on right there as well. So it seems as if they're trying to make the case out there that the inflection point has been passed in terms of improvement on inventory and some of the global sales. Mid-30s% growth on the top line for Jordan brand, both in North America and internationally. So clearly they're saying the franchise is well intact, even if it's a little bit sloppy on the financial side. Gross margin down 140 basis points in the quarter, and that accounts for the earnings miss, Mel.
All right, Mike, thank you. Mike Santoli. They had to make a dent in the inventory somehow, Karen, and that was through a lot of discounting.
Right. Although, Foot Locker had that disastrous quarter, which I'm quite familiar with because I've owned it for a long time. But Nike went down in sympathy with that. Inventory was the problem there. And so I think this is somewhat digested. This shouldn't be surprising at all. And I think it's not so surprising. Tim had a good call on this one. Like, it's a great company, but a little overbought.
Yeah, we just spent a few minutes talking about the S&P at 19 or 20 times. Here's a stock that, you know, is growing earnings in the teens on a percentage basis. I think that gross margin trend you want to obviously keep a close eye on, because this is something that, given the inflationary environments and all the like, we've kind of been very in tune with over the last couple of years or so. But at 29 times, I mean, it's expensive for a company that's maybe executing okay. You know, this is a company that is always traded at a premium in the market and many of its peers. But I don't think there's anything in this environment where you want to run out and go buy a stock like this right now after that quarter.
Yeah, Tim, your call into the quarter was your long puts into the quarter, correct? You closing that out?
No, I'm short the stock.
Are you short the stock outright?
I've been short the stock for 8 weeks or so after it shot up into the near 130s. And the view was valuation. The view was, like, everything Foot Locker told us. They're not the tail and Nike the dog, but they certainly are a canary when they're 55 to 60% of their mix is Nike. Look, I get back to where I think we are with soft lines, even premium brands like Nike, where you just aren't going to see the consumer continue to have the ability to buy here. They warned that we were here. They've done a great job of turning around the inventory story, but back to that 28 and a half times the $4 a share or 24 the street has. You know, what are you willing to pay? You shouldn't be paying a premium. It's kind of in line with its long-term history. I think you should be paying a discount. It's not a broken company. I don't stay here forever, but I think it goes back to 100.
All right, coming up, a chip change of heart. Shares of Micron reversing course after yesterday's upbeat outlook. So why did the semi stock end the day deep in the red? The traders dig into that next. Plus, cryptos, come one, come all. Fidelity joining the rush of firms looking to launch a Bitcoin ETF. But with the SEC still blocking the gates, do any of these funds have a future? We'll debate that when Fast Money returns.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. A major reversal for Micron today. The chipmaker, which had been up as much as 5.3% after its earnings report last night, ended the day down more than 4%. Micron is up almost 30% this year, but has been underperforming the broader chip space over the past month or so. Guy, you were talking about this on the call.
55% year-over-year decline in revenue. I was actually paying attention to this. It's the cheapest thing you can do yesterday. I'm looking at the numbers and what the hell's Mike? Why is it higher? It made no sense to me. I mean, most things don't, as you know. And now this actually does make sense to me. Then you layer on top of it, obviously, what's going on in China, the headwinds there. And now it starts to make a little more sense. And then you look at this company, which we talk about all the time. As much as we'd like to say they're through the commoditization phase of their company, they're not. And you're seeing it play out right before your very eyes. So it's not surprising that it's lower. It should actually be lower than it currently is. There'll be a level to buy it, but this was not a particularly strong quarter.
What about the earnings? Because yesterday the reaction immediately was good. Is that the revenues came in better and the guidance wasn't
Maybe it was a guidance thing. I don't know, because I'm telling you, I was actually watching in real time and I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't know what people are looking at necessarily. I think the proper reaction is the reaction we're seeing now.
Yeah. Tim?
Well, the bottom may be in terms of both destocking and inventories and maybe starting to see some stabilization in demand. But how excited are you at the top or for the top is my point. And I guess, you know, I don't think Micron really has underperformed that massively the semis, which have outperformed. I mean, it's underperformed by about 7% if you look at the stocks over the last 6 months. And I just don't think that there's a lot to be excited about. I think there's margin pressure, too, that I think that's what the street's responding to. And I think you're seeing folks, you know, follow through and worry that margins continue to get worse. So I think that's the reaction here. It's that things are probably better, but this is a glass half empty, not full.
Yeah, significant headwind from China is what the CEO said, and I'm surprised that at that time that the stock didn't have more of a reaction to that, too.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and Tim mentioned this yesterday or the other day on the show, and Carter's been talking about the semis on their relative performance to the S&P 500, and they've not been able to make a new high. And when you look at the SMH, the ETF that tracks the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, you see that right now, I mean, NVIDIA, which we know is up, you know, 200% or something on the year, it's gained, you know, $500 billion in market cap, is 18-19% of the weight of that index. And Taiwan Semiconductor, again, so when you talk about China and you think about the boost that we know that NVIDIA got out of Chinese buyers of these chips in front of these bans, you know, there's risk because the rest of the semiconductor space is actually deteriorating a little bit from some of that early outperformance. So to me, I think the whole sector is sitting in the hands of that stock right now, and I just don't see it kind of sticking around here for too much longer.
You're still short.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah. You know, shorts, you know, they get smaller as it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot more fast money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Crowding into crypto. More firms lining up to launch Bitcoin ETFs and other products. Will regulators finally budge? And what does it all mean for the trades? And we're diving back into Nike earnings, how inventories, supply chains, and even theft are impacting the athletic giant. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
Every day, thousands of Comcast engineers and technologists put people at the heart of everything they create, like Olu Sheyi, a Comcast engineer who grew up bonding with his dad over sports. This inspired him and his team to create AI Highlights technology that uses AI and machine learning to detect the major plays in a sporting event, so millions of fans have a way of catching up on their favorite sports. Learn more at ComcastCorporation.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Bitcoin putting in another strong day, staying above the key 30,000 level as Fidelity throws its name back in the ring for a spot Bitcoin ETF, the firm filing today for its Wise Origin Bitcoin Trust. The SEC denied Fidelity's first application for the fund more than a year ago. CME Group also announcing today that it plans to launch an Ether Bitcoin Ratio Futures product on July 31st, pending review by regulators. Seems like everybody's diving in. Somebody knows something.
You know our friend Stuart Sott from Current, who's been on the show? Mm-hmm. Okay, so he mentioned this to me the other day. I thought this was really interesting. So look at what all the enforcement action, all the regulation that came after Binance and FTX right. and all these other things. And now all the organizations like the BlackRocks and the Fidelities that the regulators know really well, they play in the sandbox, are coming in after all that. And I thought that was a really interesting way to think about it and think about what's happened to Bitcoin since all of this has transpired from the lows in the FTX period late last year to all the stuff over the last couple of months or so. So again, I think it probably gives some credence to the space. And I think if BlackRock and Fidelity, and Fidelity's been really early, they have a whole crypto wallet built into their sort of thing. It probably puts a floor to some degree in at least the underlying assets, in my opinion.
GBTC.
GBTC is just a rocket ship. Yeah. I mean, so the discount is still pretty big, though, 28% discount to NAV. Now, it used to be GBTC was one of the only ways to play it. It also traded a big premium. The premium days are over. One won't need to do that. There's going to be probably a handful of, but still 28% discount is a lot, though. However, this run, I think, is so big. I think it's going to take a little time for this one to get unlocked.
Let's say all these ETFs get approved, Tim. Is that bad for Coinbase? There are other ways to invest without buying the actual, you know, crypto?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think the question really is, what's the special sauce? What's the value that they can provide up and beyond what all these other platforms are doing? To the extent that they are fighting the SEC as we speak, I mean, claiming that they don't even have the regulatory authority to be acting as they are. They hope to throw this lawsuit out. By the way, Coinbase is up almost 60% off of that SEC bottom of whatever that was 3 weeks ago. Coinbase was a first mover and certainly has first mover, kind of branding around them. So but I think other people will be able to do the same thing there. Right now, Coinbase is certainly not trading as it was correlated to Bitcoin historically. It's trading based upon the pressure on them.
Coming up, we are digging in on Nike's numbers. Our next guest breaks down the latest results and the big threat facing retail. More on that next. And time to take a bite out of Apple. The Chartmaster thinks the tech giant's record gains may be about to sour. Don't go anywhere. Back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Let's get a check at how the markets ended the day. With just one trading day left in the quarter, the Dow jumped more than 250 points. The S&P up 0.5%, and the Nasdaq finishing flat, but still up nearly 30% this year, on pace for its best first half since 1983. And take a look at some of the newest market entrants. Three IPOs started trading today. Thrift store company Savers Value Village surging more than 27%. Nat Gas stock Kodiak Gas Services down by 2%, and Fidelis Insurance falling nearly 8%. Well, Nike shares are down in the after-hour session. The athletic retailer reporting its first EPS miss in 3 years, but it did beat revenue estimates for the seventh time in a row, albeit modestly. The conference call is underway right now. Let's bring in longtime retail executive Jerry Storch of Storch Advisors to discuss Nike and more. He is known for running Toys R Us and Hudson's Bay. Jerry, great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
What's your take on a stock like Nike, you know, as we enter sort of a period where there are question marks around the consumer's ability to keep spending?
Hey, look, unbelievable brand, fantastic future. You know, they make their own product. That's the ideal, being a retailer. But we're entering a time which, in my opinion, is going to be quite challenging for consumers. We continue to see persistent inflation. Consumer balance sheets are definitely stressed. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow with student loans, but you know that's not good either. So generally speaking, I'm not sold that the consumer is healthy, and I'm concerned about what things are going to look like as we get closer to Christmas.
How about the argument that there are some consumers who are not as impacted and that they will keep spending? Does Nike not fall into that category of the kind of retailer where they will keep spending? Does it have to be, you know, higher up the food chain, so to speak?
I don't think there's anywhere that's totally safe. There's no doubt that a strong brand like Nike is a much better position than a weaker brand. That being said, though, consumers are simply spending less on things, you know, on goods. And when you inflation adjust retail sales, it's been 8 or 9 straight months that sales have been negative. So basically buying less goods than consumers have in the past. We all say, okay, they've migrated to services. And there's no doubt the airlines are strong. You heard that from Delta. Accommodations are strong. But even that is slowing down on a year-over-year basis. And most of the so-called increase in services spending is actually being spent on health care and rent, you know, on housing, areas where consumers have to pay for products that have gone up in price, as well as, of course, there's a pandemic rebound on the health care side.
Hey, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. I was surprised to read that 25 to 49-year-olds have a big portion of student debt. I was actually thinking it would be lower. So that was interesting as I'm trying to look somewhere to hide. I've been hiding some in very, very high-end retail like a Louis Vuitton or a Kering. And I wonder what you think of that.
Well, high-end retailing has also been stressed, particularly in the United States. Some of that is because a big part of the growth was taking place in the aspirational segment. These are younger than your traditional, you know, well-heeled, older people who are spending in their retirement years on very expensive goods. These are people who might buy, for example, a pair of very expensive Gucci sneakers, if you want to think about Nike sneakers and Gucci sneakers, you know, for $800 or $1,000, but not do a lot of that. So that we've seen that fall off a cliff in recent months, as they're just not spending that kind of money. And even though it's true, of course, the 80-20 rule, that most of the money in luxury is spent by the richest people, it doesn't help when you lose the 20. So we see that taking place. By and large, the other part of the retail luxury market, the other high-end customers, will keep spending as long as the stock market does well, because that's the highest correlation there is anywhere in retailing between stock market performance and luxury spending. But if the stock market stalls out, I would expect that to stall out as well.
Jerry, you know, we haven't even seen the economy take that much of a dip so far, I mean, in terms of being in a recession, and yet we're seeing high levels of shrink to the point where retailers are citing it as an issue on their conference calls. How do you expect that sort of problem to shape up as we go into more of the downturn mode, when people are actually losing their jobs, unemployment ticks higher, and the consumer is even under more pressure than he or she is right now?
Well, you know, shrink has been growing rapidly, double digits over the last several years during the pandemic and in recent years, in recent year as well. So it's probably closing in on $100 billion in terms of a tax on the retail system, like retailers need another headache in addition to supply chain increases, wage increases, raw material cost increase. Now we have growing theft taking place. But most of that is organized crime. You have to keep that in mind. And why has organized crime increased so much? Well, it's easier to fence the goods. The rise of online marketplaces has certainly fueled the ability to liquidate the products very rapidly. And additionally, the laws have changed, making the risk that if you get caught, it's much less likely you're going to serve time. So the risk benefit has gotten, you know, more in favor of organized crime. And they've been doing more stealing, both earlier in the supply chain, off trucks at the port, off trains, out of warehouses, and just slash and grab in stores. It always took place in retail before, but it's definitely increased dramatically. And, you know, there is a new law that went into place just this week, the Inform Act, that's supposed to make it more transparent on these online marketplaces, who's selling what. So it's not supposed to be as easy to sell those goods. But I have a lot of confidence in the ability of the crooks to adapt, just like they have in cybercrime. And they've been moving off of the more known online marketplaces like eBay or Amazon or wherever onto P2P exchanges, where, you know, the so-called dark web, where they can sell these goods and continue to thrive. So I think it's going to keep going, unfortunately, without a lot of effort.
All right, Jerry, great, good to see you. Thank you.
My
Jerry
pleasure.
Storch, we are getting some headlines out of the Nike call on guidance. A Nike executive saying expect a full year 2024 reported revenue to grow mid-single digits. This is according to the conference call. The stock is down by 3.33%. So we're going to watch this very closely. I'm not sure how that shapes up versus what consensus was for the guidance, but we will check that out. Meantime, coming up, not a lot of magic left in this stock. By one analyst is saying it's a whole new world for Disney and it ain't looking pretty, where they say this one is heading next. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Call of the day here on Disney. KeyBank downgrading the stock to a sector weight from overweight. Analysts saying it is too soon to call a bottom in the stock, citing challenges across the media giant streaming parks and content sales businesses. Disney shares finishing just barely in the green today, up only 2% on the year. Really not much of a reaction to a downgrade here, Tim.
Well, it's at two-year lows. I mean, what do you want? I mean, I'm not saying that, and I don't know the ratings history of the analyst on this, but it's not a big shock to understand that Disney's streaming business has been stagnating, that they had the sweet spot of COVID to launch into, and that it's not a profitable business. I mean, I'd definitely push back on this, though. I'd push back on the international and domestic theme park business is crushing it. I'd push back on margins that I think are improving. Obviously, the company's gained some rationalization in terms of the streaming business, and I don't think it's growth at all costs. You know, differentiating of the bundle and what you're getting there, I'll let others decide on that. Disney's a brand, and its content is certainly at times thought to be the best or some of the best out there. Again, to me, at these levels, and let's be clear, the stock's at a COVID low level here. With a business that's significantly healthier than where it was at that point, I realize that, you know, markets react to sentiment, and certainly the COVID low might not even have priced in some of the negative cash flow dynamics yet, although, again, we thought we did.
It's interesting. I hear Tom Rogers' voice in this note, and who's that person, the TRB on the halftime report?
Josh Brown.
Is that superfluous in TRB, because the T is the reform
the
broker.
TRB, yeah.
So there's no reason to say
right.
It's like PIN number. But I'll say this. These are all things we already, so they're not really divulging anything new. And that was Josh's point. Doesn't mean they're wrong, though, necessarily. And, you know, what Tom said for a while, I mean, this is just a floundering business. Netflix specifically is eating their lunch. We played that game the other day, the Would You Rather game. You did a really odd one. The Netflix, I forget it was so it was odd, but we talked about, you know, Netflix has some tailwinds.
Versus Delta.
No, it was a home builder.
Oh, it was a home builder. And you got all upset at it, and I played your reindeer game.
You nailed it. You were up in my grill about that.
I got up on your grill.
I think 84 traded down to in December of 22. That feels like it's got a bullseye on its back.
Coming up, Apple looking all gold and delicious as it nears a $3 trillion market cap. But is this one about to fall far, far from the tree? The Chartmaster joins us next, and he's doubling down on his short call. The reason, straight ahead. Fast Money's back in two. Fall haha funny here. Another check on Nike here sees fiscal Q1 revenue flat to up a low single digit, sequential improvement in gross margin down 50 to 75 basis points. It also expects full year 2024 gross margins to expand 140 to 160 basis points on a reported basis. The stock is down 3.4%, so not too much reaction so far to this guidance. Tim, what is your take on what the company has said so far?
Well, I don't believe, as great of a brand as it is, that they're bulletproof to consumption trends, and especially as you get into apparel. And so, like, it's about margins that I think are weakening a bit. They've done a great job avoiding mass promotions, and I think it's about valuation. As I said, it just doesn't get away from you on the upside. The trends aren't going to improve dramatically. And in fact, I think it's still about figuring out where the bottom is on those trends. They didn't give you any reason to feel as if their business is strengthening here.
Turning now to Apple, which closed at a record high for a third day in a row. The tech giant inching closer to that $3 trillion market cap. The Chartmaster has been bearish on the stock for a few months now. So where does he stand? Let's bring in the Chartmaster himself, Carter Braxtonworth of Worth Charting. Carter, you're still negative, huh?
Yeah, I just don't buy into what is considered a very steep, uncorrected angle. Sequencing is important, and as strong as it's been, perpetual motion machines don't exist, right? We're getting into that kind of thing. But what's remarkable, and we'll see this next, is how poor Apple has actually been relative to its sector. In terms of what to do, if you're long and you've sold none, look, I've put it here on the screen, sell some. If you're long and you've sold some already, sell some more. If you're not involved, do you put new money to work in Apple here? If you think that's a good idea, I'll take the other side of that bet. I would initiate shorts. And if you're short, you press them. At least that's how I see it. But let's look at the charts and try to figure out the way forward together. This is a comparative chart. And this is important in the sense that this is where we were at the end of Q3, September 30, 2022. And what's remarkable, despite all of Apple's efforts, it is lagging its sector, and it's lagging dramatically the FANG index. And you can see that there. And so as good as it's been, it's not actually generating alpha compared to its peer group. Let's look at a relative chart, not a comparative chart. So this is simply a ratio chart, one thing divided by another. It's Apple relative to XLK, to its sector. And we see that it's been going straight up. That's the blue line. But look what's happened since September 30. We've started to dip. I think that period of underperformance that's been underway since September will carry until we get down to that trend line as depicted by the arrows. You'll see it in the next iteration. I think ultimately we'll get down all the way to that uptrend line on the RSI chart. Final chart, Apple itself. What do we know? We know it has just made slight new highs. It's in a steep, uncorrected advance. And again, back to sequencing, when you're ascending in a steeper and steeper angle, the risks, while it can keep going, increase that you will have what is called a correction. It's in the etymology of the word. It implies that something's incorrect about the ascent. So whether you call it a dip or a correction or a decline or a drop or a sell-off or a drawdown, it doesn't matter what word you want to use, that's what's likely sooner rather than later.
Just quickly, Carter, if you want to trim your Apple position, but you still want to be in technology, which stock would you potentially rotate into?
Well, I would either do it through the group, because that's the pure play, do XLK, or pick up something that's had a big move that has dipped a little bit. Certain semiconductors, I would do the SMH, frankly, I think Intel, a real dog, is starting to bottom.
Huh. Carter, thank you. Carter Braxtonworth. He self would you rather, by the way. But
allowed.
I thought it was an interesting, you know, he would choose Intel over Apple at this point, Tim. Would you agree with that?
Well, he did call it a dog, didn't he? I think you have a dynamic with Intel that for me, you know, and this reminds me of, you know, he was, listen to Carter, he's a wordsmith, and he was breaking down, he's doing, you know, Ed's wordsmithing what correction means. Yesterday or 2 days ago, you asked what's the difference between, I don't know, a laggard and an underperformer or something like that. And in Intel's case, it's not that it's a laggard. Intel's had structurally broken elements of their business that I think have not necessarily been corrected overnight, but are on their way to correcting, and that they certainly will be competing in some of these hot spots at some point. That's kind of the reason why I think Intel is something I can own here. And it doesn't, you know, dog versus apple. I mean, I Apple against the SMH or Apple against the Qs, I think makes more sense.
All right. Options traders are a little bit more constructive on the stock, at least in the short term. Mike Coe's got the action. Mike.
Yeah, so we did see Apple was the second busiest single stock option today, mostly short-dated call buying, most of that expiring at the end of the week. The largest activity we saw that does not expire tomorrow was the July 14th 197.5 calls. We saw about 23,500 of those trading for just under 30 cents. I will say that while the stock hit these all-time highs, the options are trading essentially at five-year lows in terms of implied volatility. People are probably just a fear of missing out cheap bids to the upside. I don't know that this is necessarily chasing the stock.
Mike, thanks. Mike Coe for more options action. Tune into the full show. That is tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, Final Trades. Time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Tim Seymour.
Yeah, gold has not loved the Fed or interest rates moving higher, but I think GDX is at the bottom of an uptrend all the way back to last September, and you buy it here.
Chairwoman.
Yes, for reasons having nothing to do with Carter's, I look at things totally differently but came to the same conclusion. Sell some Apple calls. If you're long, sell some calls again.
Dan.
I look at things exactly the way Carter does, and I see what he sees. And when I think about what Mike Coe had to say about the options in Apple, they are cheap looking out to August 4th expiration, which will catch earnings 2.5% of the stock price to buy that at the money put. To me, that looks like a cheap way to play Carter's call.
Guy.
Crack spreads are very favorable for Valero. That's VLO, Melissa.
All right. Thanks for watching Fast. CNBC documentary, China's Corporate Spy War with Eamon Javers, starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay,
when the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone,
or you say,
hang it in there,
because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak,
then this is your sign to call. Text or chat 988 for free, confidential support, anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.